Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, August 12th, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, Rabble contributor Doreen Nicol speaks to Leela Sarangi, National Director of Campaign 2000. Campaign 2000 is a network of national, regional, and local partner organizations who have come together to increase public awareness of the levels and consequences of family and child poverty in Canada. Each year, the organization releases a national report card measuring the progress, or lack of progress, of reaching the goal of eliminating poverty. Last month on the site, national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel detailed the government's announcement that it would begin the recovery of Canada Emergency Response Benefits, or CERB, from recipients that the CRA considers ineligible. In response to this announcement, Campaign 2000 released a statement saying that these clawbacks will have the gravest effect on mothers, in particular those with multiple children living on an earned income of $33,000 a year. Today, Sarangi joins Nicol to talk about this statement and also about how poverty is a systemic issue, brought on by colonialism's ongoing legacy in Canada. Solutions to poverty must look at things through a lens of dismantling racist systems in place. Here are Sarangi and Nicol in conversation. Take a listen.
Leela, could you explain to Rabble listeners what Campaign 2000 actually is and how it came to be?
So Campaign 2000 is a coalition of over 120 organizations from across the country. Together, we represent every province and territory. We're a nonpartisan coalition working to end child and family poverty. And we came about actually in 1991, but in response to the 1989 all-party federal resolution that promised to end child poverty by the year 2000. So that's where we get our name from. But in 1991, several of these organizations that were working in that space convened in Ottawa, realized that after the resolution was passed, there were no new investments into ending child poverty. Child poverty rates were getting worse. They wrote the first national report card tracking the progress or the lack of federal progress on that promise. And released it. And we've been writing those national report cards ever since. And we've grown in numbers and we release report cards as well at sub-jurisdictional, so provincial and territorial levels as well. And city levels too in Toronto.
Well, it's been over 30 years since you started. And I think things have gotten worse rather than better. So Canada seems to be doing a very poor job of addressing child poverty. Is there a cyclical or intergenerational component to this poverty?
There is an intergenerational component. We know that families will go in and out of poverty, but oftentimes there are intergenerational effects. And children who have experienced poverty will not only be more likely to live in poverty, but they have worse health and social outcomes as well. And so we see, you know, food insecurity and the effects of that, mental health, those kinds of struggles that can impact over a lifetime and across generations. And there's longitudinal data that shows that poverty rate. It's interesting because in the data that we use in our report cards, there's a two-year lag in the data that we look at. So there was, we saw in 2016 with the Canada Child Benefit, rates of poverty actually dropped as a result of that child benefit. We are now looking at early data from 2020, and we see rates of poverty dropping again because of the Canada Emergency Response Benefit. But we know that there's been no new investments into the Canada Child Benefit. We know that the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit has ended, and in fact, a lot of people have to pay it back. So yeah, the poverty rates are better than what they were in 89 and 90, 91, but we're still very, very far behind.
Campaign 2000 recently announced that many families who received pandemic benefits like CERB or the Canada Recovery Benefit are now facing reductions to their tax refundable credits. Why are these clawbacks happening?
Yeah, that's such a great question and such an important issue. So the Canada Emergency Response Benefit, you know, when it was delivered in March 2020, between March and October 2020, and then they changed that, they ended the Canada Emergency Response Benefit in October 2020, implemented the Canada Recovery Benefit. The government was saying at the time, especially in the early days of the pandemic, you know, it's we are here for you. We are having a response to the pandemic that is going to catch everybody, leaves no one behind. Apply for this Canada Emergency Response Benefit. And people did. They needed that money. The benefit was designed as a taxable income program. So it counts as people's income. So when people received the benefit, we've talked to a lot of people who received those emergency and recovery benefits. You know, people told us they were paying rent, paying food. We've been seeing the last year or so inflation rising at historically high levels. The cost of living across the board is getting higher. And those pandemic benefits went to what our new social contract was, right? Stay at home, shelter at home, buy extra personal protective equipment, sanitizing equipment, bulk order your groceries, get them delivered. Moms with kids had to buy better data program, more broadband, more bandwidth, more devices so they could either work from home or socialize from home or so kids could school from home. These were very real added costs to people's already stretched budgets. And because it was designed as a taxable income, what happens the following year at tax time is it gets counted as income in people's family net income, which is used then to calculate future benefits. So that coming year, tax year's benefits. So we saw last year with seniors had this issue with guaranteed income supplement. They used the CERB. Low-income seniors who lost work because of the pandemic took CERB payments, and then the following year was calculated into their guaranteed income supplement. And some seniors even lost that benefit. It took them over the threshold and they lost that benefit. We're seeing it again. We saw it with the Canada Child Benefit last year as well. Anybody who's received that recovery benefit and where that recovery benefit takes them over the threshold, where that means the child benefit starts to get reduced. That's what we've been seeing now. And it was just last week that families would have received that letter from CRA that tells them how much they'd be eligible for in this coming year for their Canada Child Benefit. The seniors benefit, the guaranteed income supplement, is not an issue in the same way this year. I mean, it wasn't perfect, the resolution that the federal government put in place, and people, seniors are falling through the cracks. But what they did do is repay low-income seniors the amount that they were clawed back of their guaranteed income supplement and changed legislation. So it's legislated now that pandemic benefits will not be calculated into their income supplements. And so what we've been asking the federal government to do is the same thing for low-income, moderate-income families who receive the child benefit, ensuring that any clawbacks that they've had gets repaid to them so they're made whole, and that it's legislated that the emergency and recovery benefits are not calculated into future calculations of the Canada Child Benefit.
Federal government will eventually, over 3 years, claw back $1.4 billion. How are these clawbacks going to impact moderate and low-income families?
It's really going to affect the moderate-income moms. Low-income families are protected by that threshold. So the Canada Child Benefit doesn't actually start to reduce until your earned income is around $33,000 or more, your family's earned income. So anybody whose income is less than that $33,000 is protected from clawbacks. So we're really talking about moderate income moms who go to work and are earning about $33,000 a year or more, who will start to see a reduction in that Canada Child Benefit. What we know is that $33,000 plus your benefits is still not a thriving wage. Moms are still stretched and having to make decisions around their purchases, budgeting for every dollar, and spending $1.45 billion less is a very significant divestment of funds into a program that we know has significant impact on the well-being and the lives of families and children. So this is going to hit moms. It's going to hit moms the hardest. The clawbacks will hit moms the hardest who have multiple children and who have those moderate incomes. And those really are the moms who are going to need it most. And they'll see clawbacks in the area of around $3,000 for the year. So it's a very significant amount that they'll go without. And, you know, one of the problems is that this has not been communicated out, right? Like, families were not expecting benefits that they received in many cases over a year ago to now be impacting future benefits geared towards helping them make ends meet.
Poverty is often mistakenly blamed on individuals making poor personal choices. But the reality is poverty is rooted in systemic inequalities and systemic racism. So can you explain to listeners how these inequalities and how racism are the real root causes of poverty?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Doreen. I think it is so important that we understand poverty as both a result of systemic oppressions and colonization, but also as a way to maintain inequalities. So it's an active mechanism in our society. So we're still a colonized nation, and the legacies of colonialism are alive and well. So we can't look away from those very real impacts. When we look at the child poverty rates, for example, the national child poverty rate is 17.7%. But when we look at who is poor in those, and we look at the disaggregated data, what we see is First Nations children living on reserve have a child poverty rate of 53%. More than one in two of their children live in poverty, have very, you know, we have blow water advisories, lack of access to medication, services, programs, housing, food security, affordable food. These are all issues that stem from our legacy and ongoing legacy of colonization. When we look at the child poverty rates for racialized children, immigrant and newcomer children, they're 25%, 33%. For Black Canadian children, it's 30%. These are real reflections of those systemic inequalities and systemic racism and colonization and patriarchy and ableism, you know, that our systems are still built on. So any solutions that we are putting forward really address the dismantling of those systems and rebuilding from real equity and inclusion and lived and living expertise. When we look at, like, for example, work and precarious work, and in the context, I'll just talk about one example in the context of the pandemic, right? We saw who accessed the CERB. We just talked about the CERB. The Statistics Canada put a report out last year that showed who accessed the CERB. It was low-income women, racialized, Indigenous, and young people, people who are more likely to have precarious labor market attachment, and who would not have been caught in the employment insurance program that was in place at the time. That's why the CERB was developed. When the broadened criteria were designed for the CERB, it actually caught a whole range of people who have this precarious labor market attachment and received the CERB. And on that, any people who are, like, going to be asked to pay back the CERB, it's these folks who we're talking about, those folks who are already dealing with systemic marginalization, who are going to be harder hit with the CERB repayments.
I recently had Professor Dennis Raphael from York University on the show, and he believes programs like Campaign 2000 are a distraction from solving the real issues, and those issues being low-paying, non-unionized jobs that are part-time work. Is Campaign 2000 a distraction?
So I don't believe that Campaign 2000 is a distraction. And actually, we have a 5-point platform that we put forward in all of our report cards that address inequality, these systemic inequalities. It addresses income security. It addresses the creation of decent work that includes labor protections, health protections, including for precarious workers, for workers who don't have status, who have precarious immigration status. Part of our platform is well-funded, robust public services, including access to childcare. And in our last report card, we put forward a childcare model. You know, the government's developing this national system of childcare. They're investing $30 billion into this system that childcare advocates have been asking for 50 years. And we put forward a $0 to $10 a day model for childcare so that it reaches women who are living in poverty who wouldn't be able to afford on average $10 a day, making sure those spaces are in communities and accessible, but also addressing the workforce. It's about 93% of the workforce in childcare are racialized women. And we've been advocating for the creation of decent work training, public wage grids, so that that workforce has a decent work model. And that those infrastructure dollars that are being invested into the building of new childcare spaces are attached to community benefit agreements at the local level. So how do local communities benefit from those jobs? How are they trained and supported to enter into those infrastructure jobs and benefiting from those infrastructure investments? Also included in our public service platform is the creation of deeply affordable housing that meets the needs of families living in low income, including First Nations, Indigenous, and public healthcare and pharmacare, and pharmacare that includes also full Medicare vision and dental programs as well.
I also had a political scientist, Ron Heichel, on the show recently, and he thinks it's time for a basic income right now. Would a basic income help lift these children out of poverty?
We have six principles we've put forward for a basic income plan. What we talk about in our report cards is, yeah, fixing the income security system, which I think is the bottom line here, and raising that income floor. We've actually focused on the Canada Social Transfer, and that is the block funding that the federal government gives to the provinces and territories to fund things like social assistance, disability assistance, childcare, and education. Right now, that there is a cap on the amount the federal government can invest into that program. It's an arbitrary cap, and it results in a lack of adequate investment. So we've asked for the federal government to lift that cap, start with a full $1 billion investment into that block transfer, and constitutionally tie conditions to that transfer. So provinces and territories are on the hook for making sure the money they're spending in those programs is advancing our human rights obligations, making sure that those income security programs are working, all of them are working together to drive incomes up to that low income measure. If that was in place already, we wouldn't have seen the kind of fallout we saw with the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit, with the CERB. We wouldn't see those kinds of interactions and clawbacks that we saw. And, you know, the clawbacks that happened at the provincial level, where people on social assistance received the CERB in most parts of the country, had their social assistance clawed back right away. And those clawbacks went back into the coffers of the provinces and territories. And so we saw reporting about how provinces and territories reserves actually grew. And it was because they were clawing back social assistance from CERB recipients. And so making sure that those kinds of conditions would be attached to federal government, they have the power to do that. They do it with the health transfer. So there is precedent set, would be really transformative in terms of lifting up incomes, making sure those programs are actually meeting the income needs and addressing income poverty.
Finally, Campaign 2000 is collecting CERB and CRB stories to help advocate for an amnesty. Tell listeners about this great project.
So it was identified to us actually very early on through many of Campaign 2000 members that people who were receiving the CERB and who were on social assistance were seeing their social assistance reduced. And this was a real concern. And so we've been collecting these stories. What we are hearing over and over again is that the CERB was important because it did bring incomes up. It was, in many cases, the first time people were able to meet their basic needs and not stress about it. They felt they could take care of their kids and pay rent and buy their medication. And then when all the reconciliation started happening at the federal level, the kind of unnecessary fear and stress it has caused for people in the cases of seniors who lost their GIS, very real impacts of losing housing, losing all of their belongings, homelessness. We heard stories about, I heard from somebody who was living in the Northwest Territories who was evicted and in the winter living, a senior person living in their car in the wintertime because they lost the GIS. And when they lost GIS, they lost a bunch of territorial benefits they also would have been eligible for. I talked to moms who lost provincial childcare supplements and things like that. So, there was a trail of devastation of these stories. And so we have developed a set of recommendations. We have written to ministers, MPs. We've presented these in budget consultations, both in our written submissions, but in our public presentations as well. And as CERB Amnesty, what we are asking for is for the federal government to immediately cease pursuing anybody living on low or moderate incomes for repayments, immediately stopping the clawbacks. And that's where we've seen success with the seniors. They will not see any more clawbacks as a result of receiving the CERB to their GIS, and they've been refunded their amounts. And those recommendations with the Canada Social Transfer, we have asked for as part of this package to look at some of the longer term solutions, tying those transfers through the Canada Social Transfer, putting conditions onto that transfer. And reinstating, so with this last federal budget, we saw the end of all income security programs, but we know we're in the middle of another COVID wave. People are still getting very, very sick, but we don't have any more income security programs to help people who are either off of work sick or off of work because they are caring for someone who is sick. And so part of what we have been asking for is to reinstate those emergency benefits at that initial $500 a week until employment insurance is reformed. And employment insurance reform is in process. But again, in the budget, the latest budget, we didn't see any money earmarked for this new employment insurance program that's supposed to be, as I understand, released in September. That's, just about a month away. So it's causing a lot of precarity for folks.
Layla, thanks for stopping by today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Doreen Nickel and Leela Sarangi in conversation. You can read Doreen's full story based on this interview on the site today. Thanks so much for that, Doreen and Leela. Now it's time for a segment we call In Case You Missed It. And for that, I'll hand it over to Rabble's editor, Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Breaking news this week, Unifor has a new national president, Lana Payne. Payne, previously employed as National Secretary Treasurer, has been elected as the new president of Canada's largest private sector union. Payne was elected by the delegates at Unifor's 4th Constitutional Convention and is the first woman to hold this position. Payne succeeds former national president Jerry Diaz, who stepped down after almost a decade leading the union. Diaz left the Unifor in March after an alleged constitutional breach for which the investigation continues. Payne defeated executive assistant to the president Scott Doherty and Unifor local 444 president Dave Cassidy. After her election, Payne said, "Today we turn a page. Today we move forward. Today and every day, we put our members at the heart of everything we do." This week in Canadian politics, Rabble national reporter Stephen Wenzel details the federal government's decision to ban the importation of handguns into the country, which will be taking effect on August 19th. The ban marks a shift by the federal government to rely on regulations while more comprehensive legislation in the form of Bill C-21 continues to move through the House of Commons. The bill so far has passed its second reading by MPs. Bill C-21 represents some of the strongest gun control measures since the 1970s. The legislation would result in an immediate freeze on handguns, a move that would effectively cap the number of handguns in the country while also preventing the importation of new ones. Regulations have already been amended to ensure the handgun freeze comes into force sometime this fall. Also on the site this week, in her column this month, Natasha Darling examines a few successful non-criminal cases that bring hope for advancing rights for sex workers. Darling outlines the case of Nicole Gilliland, a nursing student who was let go from her college after professors and administration discovered she was once a porn performer. Due to the stigma against sex workers in her small town, when Gilliland brought her case to court, she was risking more than her opportunity to become a nurse. Her mental health took a dive, and she lost her housing and had to fight to keep custody of her children. In the end, though, Gilliland was awarded a $1.7 million settlement. Finally, columnist Maya Bular shared how the Canadian Labour Congress is fighting to support unionized workers in Bangladesh's garment industry nearly 10 years after the Rana Plaza collapse. In 2013, over 111 garment workers working in the Rana Plaza building in Zavara, Bangladesh, died when the structure collapsed. The collapse came after weeks of complaints by workers that the structure was unsafe, which was ignored by their employer. In addition to supporting unionization efforts in Bangladesh, the Canadian Labour Congress is also pressuring Canadian companies to only do business with factories in the country that have committed to safer working conditions. You can catch all of those stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Thanks so much, Nick. The last thing we'd like to leave you with, listeners, is this. There are many urgent issues facing us today, ranging from the climate crisis to racism and hate. Rabble's publisher, Kim Elliott, underscores the critical role Rabble plays in organizing for change.
When I think about what excites me most about Rabble, it's how it brings together grassroots activists with trained journalists, with academics, with emerging writers, and with well-known authors, all on a national platform. We're in a time when we need to hear from as many progressive voices as possible to work towards solutions to the critical problems that are facing us. And Rabble is a space that can play a part in that. We also do that through partnerships with places like the Tommy Douglas Institute at George Brown College that brings the Courage My Friend podcast. We do that with the Institute for Change Leaders, where we have our Journalism for Change Fellowship. We do that in many other ways. And the people who come to Rabble are excited to be part of making social change. They feel the urgency, and you feel that in their writing. And that's what I find exciting and why I've been with Rabble for 15 years.
Now is the time for progressives to take action. Amid our summer fundraisers, support independent media with staying power. Visit rabble.ca/donate for more information. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Are you interested in sharing Rabble Radio on your campus, college, or local radio station? Please email brianne@rabble.ca to learn how you can host our show on your programming every week. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.